the group that we are facing that has unleashed this particular attack on us and others is a very well-organized group.
The Mat-Su Bureau issues a disaster declaration as it deals with a computer virus. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 1st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a Native Hawaiian is forced to change the name of her Anchorage restaurant due to copyright issues over the word aloha.
I know some people are like, it's such a generic word, everyone says it, but not to our people.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Landing a job in Alaska's high-demand industries like welding, construction, medical billing, or marine transportation is now more affordable. The University of Alaska has reduced tuition for more than 300 career and technical education courses by 25%. From Ketchikan to Kotzebue, there has never been a better time to get started on your path to a new career. Learn more at www.alaska.edu/starthere. This message brought to you by the University of Alaska.
The nation's annual defense policy bill cleared Congress today with a pay raise for the troops and a provision allowing up to 6 icebreakers. If the icebreaker part sounds familiar, that's because last year's defense authorization bill had something similar, but it was stripped out before final passage. This year's bill, though, is on its way to the president's desk for his signature. Congress included a non-binding note with the bill saying the first of the 6 heavy icebreakers should be delivered by 2023. The bill also allows $287 million in military construction projects for Alaska, according to Senator Dan Sullivan's office. The annual bill authorizes Pentagon programs and provides a budget outline, but the actual spending is decided in the appropriations bills Congress has to pass each year to keep the government operating. The military pay raise of 2.6% is the largest since 2010. A computer virus disrupting Matanuska-Susitna Bureau services has prompted a disaster declaration due to its severity and magnitude. The declaration allows access to emergency funds, possibly from the federal government. Efforts to isolate the virus last week forced the borough's IT department to disable phones and computers, and some borough employees have had to use typewriters and handwrite receipts. That receipt writing in particular has reportedly caused delays at the borough landfill. Chief Information Officer Eric Wyatt says the incident is known as a zero-day attack, meaning the methods used were not known to antivirus software and security experts before the attack was launched. Wyatt updated the borough assembly at its meeting last night on the impacts of the attack and what is being done to get the borough's computer systems back online. He describes the virus as the worst of its type.
The group that we are facing that has unleashed this particular attack on us and others is a very well-organized group, and they're using the most sophisticated tools and have done a lot of damage across the country to include us.
Wyatt says the virus sat dormant for a time before causing problems. He says there are so far more than 200 other victims across the country. The virus is thought to have infiltrated the borough systems through an employee clicking on a link or attachment in a fraudulent email known as a phishing attack. The borough is working with the FBI, other agencies, and local businesses to get systems up and running. But that process takes time. And while it may be a while before the systems are at 100%, Wyatt believes most functions should be restored by later this month.
But we should have all primary functions back online by early next week. And then within about 3 weeks, we may be to a 90% capability.
All that work is not free. Between new software and hardware and overtime for staff, Wyatt says the cost to recover from an attack like this is normally around $1 million for an organization the size of the borough, though he adds that current cost estimates are lower. Also, the borough does carry cyber attack insurance. City of Valdez computers have also been infected by what is thought to be the same virus. The municipality of Anchorage has so far not seen any sign of the virus nor suffered any kind of similar disruptions. Governor Bill Walker's Climate Action Leadership Team has been discussing a robust draft plan to tackle climate change. The draft mentions a number of ways to go about that, from beefing up efforts to monitor ocean acidification to better educating the public on the causes of warming. But the state is going to need a way to pay for it all, and the plan addresses that too. Alaska should consider a carbon tax, it says. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Task Force member Luke Hopkins lives in a home in Fairbanks built on permafrost. As the climate warms, he says his own foundation is changing.
I would say that if I put a ball on the floor, one aspect of my house, it would roll a little bit.
It's not a problem Hopkins sees going away. He thinks Alaska needs to update its engineering and design standards to better respond to homes like his on melting permafrost. The draft climate action plan includes language to do that. But those efforts require more research, and that requires money. Hopkins says the draft plan suggests a solution to generate that funding.
Where's that going to come from? Well, carbon pricing has been used elsewhere in the country and the world, and so we think we ought to look at it.
At least seven states have proposed carbon pricing legislation. Carbon pricing is basically this broad term for putting a price on CO2 emissions. It can include things like a carbon tax or a cap and trade program. Alaska's draft plan recommends the state should think about endorsing a national strategy to put a price on carbon, while also taking steps to implement its own carbon tax. The most commonly talked about way that could work is, as fuel comes out of the ground, oil and gas companies would pay a fee. And that cash would be used to help fund various energy efficiency projects and more studies to better understand the impacts of climate change. Like, how could homeowners like Hopkins stabilize their house as the permafrost thaws? Hopkins says thinking long-term about some form of carbon pricing is a good idea.
Many of these things have to be looked at in depth. We're just putting out what our recommendations would be for the goals that we have.
Chantal Walsh with the state's Department of Natural Resources co-chaired a committee with industry representatives. The group has been providing some feedback to the governor's climate action team. As for a state or a national carbon tax, Walsh says there's more that needs to happen before they can have that discussion.
It doesn't make any sense to do individual states by any means. And there's also the question of, does it do any good to be one nation doing this?
Instead, Walsh thinks scoping out some kind of policy for putting a price on carbon around the world makes the most sense. In a letter submitted to the Climate Action Team, BP expressed strong reservations about a state carbon pricing program. Luke Hopkins believes there is still a lot that could change in the draft plan before it's submitted to the governor by September. But he thinks something about carbon pricing will likely be in the final version.
I think it will stick in the plan. I don't think there's an overwhelming consensus in the group recently that says we don't want to put anything in there about carbon pricing. That's why it's in the plan right now.
The Climate Action Leadership Team will be looking at the draft policy statement on carbon pricing when they go through the plan at their in-person meeting on Thursday in Anchorage. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, several Tlingit teenagers make a rap video to showcase their culture and heritage.
It's only okay to say I smoke a fat pound of if salmon is what's at the end.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
An Anchorage restaurant owner has found herself in the middle of a national debate involving copyright infringement and cultural appropriation. Tasha Kahele is a native Hawaiian. In April, she opened Aloha Poke Stop. Then in May, she got a letter from a Chicago-based chain demanding she change her restaurant's name. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell reports.
Tasha Kahele is really proud of her new restaurant in East Anchorage.
I may be a little biased, but I think we make some of the best poke in Anchorage here. Have you tried our poke?
I have not.
Oh boy, Emily.
Kahele opened Aloha Poke Shop in April. In Hawaiian, the word poke means to dice, cube, or cut. At Kahele's shop, you can order cubed raw fish with wasabi ginger, have it Hawaiian style with limu or seaweed, even California style with avocado, crab, and cucumbers.
We have poke at our luaus, we have poke at our get-togethers.
A staple of Kahele's native Hawaiian culture. Another staple of that culture, the word aloha.
When you walk into a business that has aloha and you have Native Hawaiian family working in it, you can expect that kind of spirit, that kind of food, that kind of experience when you walk in the door.
But just weeks after opening, Kahele got a letter. It was from a lawyer representing the Chicago-based Aloha Poke Company, which is owned and operated by non-Hawaiians. "Your use of Aloha and Aloha Poke must cease immediately," the letter read. Kahele says she was devastated, but she knew she couldn't afford the legal fees to fight it.
"This is not our first business, so I understand the copyright and the trademark, and so which is why we were so torn. We knew that we'd have to comply, right? But this, like I said, this was very unique. You know, it was a word that they should have never been able to trademark or copyright, especially those two words together."
A letter similar to Kahele's was made public after it was sent to another Native Hawaiian business owner. That spread online, creating a massive angry uproar. The Aloha Poke Company has since apologized on its Facebook page. To those who care about the Hawaiian culture, it said, quote, "We want to say to them directly how deeply sorry we are that this issue has been so triggering," unquote.
You know, it's hard to accept an apology that doesn't sound so genuine, and it leaves out a lot.
On top of that, the company is still insisting it owns Aloha and Aloha Poke when used in connection with restaurants, catering, and takeout service. Kahele says it's not right for a company to try to take ownership of her people's native language.
"I know some people are like, it's such a generic word. Everyone says it, but not to our people. It's not. Aloha encompasses everything. And so it's so important that we hold that word sacred. We live aloha, we give it, we share it. It's not to be restricted. And I think that's why it's so triggering to people, and it's so offensive, and it's so hurtful. It's hurtful for our family, it's hurtful."
For Native Hawaiians like Kahele, though, this appropriation of her culture, it's nothing new.
"Hawaii has been commercialized and colonized, and our culture has been appropriated in so many ways.
Like, for example, associating any Hawaiian-style food with pineapples. Customers, Kahele says, will come into her shop and ask about her traditional style of poke.
They're like, oh, the Hawaiian-style poke, does that have pineapples in it? And I'm like, no, it has a very traditional nut base, kukui nut base, that makes it Hawaiian.
Kahele's restaurant shows off her traditional food and native culture. It's also a family business, which is why Kahele chose to rename her shop Lei's Poke Stop after her daughter, Lei, standing behind the register.
"If at another time we have to fight anyone for the word Lei, that's
good luck."
Good luck. My daughter said good luck.
In Anchorage, I'm Emily Russell.
If you live in a place that's particularly vulnerable to climate change, you want to know specifics about what that change is going to look like in the future. How high can you expect storm surges to be? How much is the permafrost going to thaw, and how fast? From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has this report on a project that's trying to get the Arctic closer to some of those answers.
On a spot of uneven tundra, just a 15-minute drive from downtown Utqiagvik, Alistair Rogers stands surveying his experimental domain, several structures connected by a webbed plastic pathway.
Okay, so what we're looking at here is kind of a greenhouse that's covered with a plastic membrane.
Rogers is a plant physiologist, and he's part of a team of scientists with the U.S. Department of Energy who are working at four sites around Alaska. They're looking at things that happen on land, like microbial activity in the permafrost, the spread of shrubs across the tundra, and in Roger's case, how tundra plants interact with the atmosphere. Inside one of the greenhouses, Roger's colleague Kim Eli bends over a small boxy piece of equipment.
What I have here is a machine that we're measuring photosynthesis and respiration rates, and it's currently clamped on a little leaf down here that's within the measurement chamber.
The humming machine has a name tag, partly so it doesn't get mixed up with the others, and partly because Rogers is a bit of a sports fan.
They're all named after New York Yankees players. So there's Bernie and Andy and Jorge and Derek and Mariano.
The photosynthesis measurement being taken by the Bernie box will eventually become math.
So photosynthesis, for example, there's a bunch of equations which describe how the holes on the leaves open up and let CO2 in and let water out.
And those equations will be used to make projections about how the Arctic will be impacted by climate change. While there's been a good amount of data collected on that kind of thing in different parts of the world, like the grasslands and the temperate forests, in the Arctic, there's been hardly any.
What we're trying to do is make better predictions so that we can basically provide policymakers with more useful, actionable information.
Rogers says that his team has already gathered data that's helped revise some previous assumptions about how Arctic vegetation works. They hope that the combined work of all the teams on the project will refine their understanding of what may happen in the Arctic of the future. The data is publicly available. Scientists working on climate projections or any other research can access it online. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig, Inuit Keavik.
Voting might seem simple enough. You head to your precinct, fill out your ballot, and feed it through a machine. But the scenarios election workers face at the polls can get a lot more complicated. Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry headed to a poll worker training in Anchorage to learn the ins and outs of voting in Alaska ahead of the primary later this month.
What do you do next?
About 10 volunteers stand around a table watching poll worker Darlene Heiser during a mock election. She's been volunteering for close to 10 years and still stumbles on some of the questions. It's a lot to remember. Scenarios range from voters coming in without identification, to absentee voters wanting to vote in person, to this.
Hi. I know it's 8:02, but there was a bad accident on Lake Otis, and I got here as quickly as I could, and I'm not a bad person, and it was an act of God.
Well,
can we please vote anyway?
We could certainly set you up with the question ballot, because we've already closed the polls are closed.
That's Julie Hussman with the Division of Elections, stepping in with guidance. It's been a hard year for recruiting, she says. They run a youth ambassador program that pays high school students to work the polls, and they employ members of the Job Corps program. But most of their workers are volunteers.
Part of the reason we don't have the election workers that we've had, because the people who have consistently done it for years and years, they are aging and they can't do it anymore, and so we're not getting that new, fresh, young blood to continue on.
She explains that in the primary election, candidates for the Democratic, Independents, and Libertarian parties are listed on one ballot, and Republicans are listed on the other. Registered Republican, undeclared, and nonpartisan voters can opt for either ballot, while the others only get one choice. And that's because each party makes its own rules. Hussman says maintaining voter privacy while helping them understand their options is imperative.
Let's say they have a choice of a ballot. You would say, you have the choice of the either ballot. Could you please point to the one you'd like to receive? And so then they would point without having to state it out loud.
The state prohibits electioneering within 200 feet of a polling place, and that includes carrying signs, wearing a candidate's T-shirt, campaign button or hat, or discussing ballot measures, she explains. Then she demonstrates how to feed a sample ballot into a sturdy black box.
Music to our ears!
Their current equipment is slated to be upgraded by 2020. Still, Hussman says that the current system doesn't compromise security. She cautions volunteers to always keep equipment and ballots under lock and key, and then asks for any questions. A new volunteer pipes up.
Any kind of ID works for this? It doesn't have to be a photo?
Nope. In the state of Alaska, we do not ask for photo ID.
Over the last decade, several states have passed new voter ID laws. Proponents of the laws say they combat election fraud. Opponents say the laws target vulnerable populations who may not have easy access to photo identification, like the homeless.
A lot of places may not have a way of getting a photo ID. Let's go out to a village. Maybe they do not have the accessibility to get a photo ID.
Hussman says that Alaska has other ways of combating voter fraud. For example, their system tells them if a voter has already cast an absentee ballot or voted early. A utility bill, or in many cases, a verbal identification from someone working at the polling place, is enough to confirm someone's identity. She ends the 3-hour training with a touch of humor.
Don't be scared. It's going to be okay. All right? We'll give out one ballot is my main thing. One ballot.
Voters can also choose to vote early or absentee. Early voting starts August 6th. The August 21st primary includes 9 gubernatorial candidates and Alaska's U.S. representative seat. The general election takes place on Tuesday, November 6th. In Anchorage, I'm Erin McKinstry.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. Search offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at Search. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
A national organization called the Polaris Project takes young scientists into the field to study climate change in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. But last year, a Bethel researcher who participated said the group marginalized her project because it relied on traditional knowledge. Now, the organization is trying to make amends. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Christy Schallenberger reports from Bethel.
It's helicopter day for the Polaris Project.
Are you guys excited?
That means for the entire day, a helicopter acts like a taxi, shuttling students across the tundra so they don't have to lug heavy research equipment across the spongy ground. Darcy Peter is a returning fellow from last year, and she is sitting out this round. She injured her knee, so she spends her time boosting morale at camp and conducting her research with help from other fellows. She loves the Polaris Project.
This is a crazy experience. Last year was the best year. It was the best month of my life, so.
Peter is Alaska native from the interior village of Beaver. She was with Polaris last year when fellow scientist Jasmine Gill told KYUK that the organization did not take her project seriously.
I don't like how things were handled. I definitely don't.
Jasmine Gill is from Bethel and is Yupik. She moved with her family to Sitka when she was 10, but spent her summers traveling between Gwethlik and Bethel. And she was the only scientist from the YK Delta last year. Her project combined Western science and Yupik knowledge to find out why lakes are disappearing in the region. In an interview last year, Gill said some scientists at Polaris tried to persuade her to study something else.
And I said, no. This is important to the people here. And I work to reflect where I come from and who I am and the people that I care for.
Gill declined to be interviewed for this story. She says she is moving on from the controversy. Sue Natale is one of the lead scientists of the Polaris Project, which is part of the Woods Hole Research Center based in Massachusetts. She was also there last year, and she says at the time, she didn't know about the tension between Gill and Polaris.
I was very excited by her science project. We provided a lot of helicopter time for her, and I really regret that she felt that way because she actually had an awesome project. And she has a really good insight, and that wasn't communicated to me.
Now a year later, Polaris is trying to repair the damage. Natale says that they have built in more one-on-one time with students and more group meetings to catch all concerns and potential problems. Polaris researchers also hosted a community meeting in Bethel this year after their two-week research session ended. As part of the meeting, one of the Polaris Project scientists, Paul Mann, asked the crowd for suggestions.
And what would you say to the next generation here, or these, about what should be looked at?
Darcy Peters says the solution is pretty simple. Western scientists actually need to sit down with elders and the community to find out what they want to know. And that way, scientists can also start forming relationships with people who have lived in the area for a long time.
Science is like the black and white, and traditional knowledge is like the firsthand observations and looking at changes over time because we've been there for so long, versus scientists who just go in there and do a few studies and bail out. So
next year, Polaris researchers say they will do two meetings in Bethel, one before the group heads out to do research and another after it's concluded. That way, the group can have more insight from the community and also spend more time building relationships. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
A group of Alaska Native teenagers on Monday premiered a bilingual hip-hop video showcasing their pride in their culture and Southeast Alaska. The video is now up on the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida YouTube channel. KTOO's Adeline Baxter spoke with the budding hip-hop artists behind it.
Even though we're Northwest, we still rep the Southeast. Sit back and
the video is called Iksakan Akwan. Translation, I love you, my people. In it, AJ Hoyle blends Tlingit and English lyrics together over a native drumbeat. Hoyle is a lanky 17-year-old with a big afro. In the video, he raps with hip-hop star swagger across Southeast Alaska, including from the center of a canoe full of paddlers and fields of fireweed. The video and lyrics are fun, silly, and at times absurd. Bananas feature prominently for some reason. They eat them, throw them, and dance with them on camera. Boyle wrote most of the lyrics himself.
So I was the rapper, and also known as the MC.
He'd written raps before and speaks Klingit pretty well, but this was his first time rhyming in another language. That's why some of the lyrics seem random, even while playing with some familiar hip-hop themes.
I pick those blueberries. I love my mom. I smoked a fat pound of salmon. Ich sachan nach Kwan.
He also includes a shout-out to This Is Angoon, a Southeast Alaska hip-hop favorite by TNT and Swerve Merv.
This is Juno, ain't no Angoon.
Are you throwing it down for Angoon? Is this a challenge?
Yeah. You gotta shout them out or else they don't go get no publicity no more. And like, you know, if I have to shout out This Is Angoon, that's good because now all of Alaska's known.
The video shows the group canoeing on Auk Lake, exploring Haines, riding the ferry, fishing and picking blueberries. Everything from the video production to ferry tickets and snacks were paid for through grant money promoting health and well-being under a tribal suicide prevention program.
So when we were doing our storyboard for the lyrics, we really wanted to have images that illustrate Indigenous life in Southeast.
That's Will Chronic. He coordinates the suicide prevention program for the Klingit and Haida Central Council. Chronic says the grant was fairly open-ended, so he let the students choose what they wanted to do.
They decided, let's do a music video. And all the different scenes came out of that too, because students wanted to do outdoor things, they wanted to go canoeing, they wanted to go fishing. So really all of the ideas came from students.
Chronic, Hoyle, and another student, Marcel Cohen, worked on the lyrics for about a month. Once they had them, it took 2 days to produce the song with help from Joshua Laboka, a sound engineer who also helped produce the video. That took about 10 days.
I didn't do any micromanaging of them. All I said was just do what you know, and then we'll go from there. They weren't camera shy on each of the days, and that's what made the whole thing smooth, and that's what made it fun.
The 7 students who worked on the video ranged from 13 to 17. Most attend high school in Juneau, except for Jacob Brulette. He's from Elim, outside of Nome.
I was visiting for the summer, and I was pretty much loafing around, and then all of a sudden my grandma wanted me to get out of the house, came to this, and that's how it started. I was the sound slash comedian slash actor.
Since Brulette is Yupik and Inuit, he contributed a little bit of his own culture for the video. He demonstrates a broad jump common at events like Native Youth Olympics. So what did these teenagers take away from the experience?
New friends and a lot of days without sleep.
Potassium.
Potassium.
Blueberries. Don't forget about
that. It's
mom.
Only okay to say I smoke a fat pound of if salmon is what's at the end.
As for their next project, the group already has plans for a music video inspired by Childish Gambino's This Is America. Expect This Is Alaska to hit the internet sometime in the not too distant future. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Elizabeth Jenkins and Adeline Baxter in Juneau, Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik, Aaron McKinstry and Emily Russell in Anchorage, and Christy Schallenberger in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.